conversations that you connect with and react to. SAFM.
All right, we continue the conversation on the Talking Point. Coming up in this hour, we're speaking to the Hlanganisa Community Fund for Social and Gender Justice. They've been reflecting on 30 years of democracy and in particular what the state of women of this country are 30 years on, and also just, I think, taking a very gendered look at where we have seen signs of progress, what those have been, but also where there have been signs of regression. How do we then begin to change things? Let me welcome onto the show Bongiwe Ndondo, Executive Director for the Hlanganisa Community Fund for Social and Gender Justice. Bongiwe, good morning.
Morning, Kathy, and morning to your viewers. Thank you for having us.
And Bongani Ndlovu is the SEF Project Manager, also with Hlanganisa. Good morning, Bongani.
Morning, Kathy, and good morning to all the listeners. Thank you.
Bongiwe, a good starting point would perhaps be just to talk about who is Hlanganisa, what is Hlanganisa, and what do you guys do?
Thank you, Kathy. So Hlanganisa is a community fund. So we provide financial resources and technical resources to the community-based sector, so to the grassroots sector. We work, at grassroots level and try and empower organizations and initiatives that already exist. Our focus is around gender justice, climate justice, social accountability, and access to justice. And so over the years, you know, we've supported various social justice initiatives that is implemented through grassroots organizations. One of the key aspects of our work is also strategy convenings. So we want to have dialogue and conversations in strategic sectors to try and advance some of the social issues impacting different groups. And the particular mention, you mentioned our work 30 years post-democracy, that is part of the conversation and igniting, you know, those important and strategic conversations around the status of women in South Africa.
It's an important question to ask, especially as we mark 30 years of this country's democracy. So what then is the state of women 30 years on?
I think, you know, if you look at South Africa, you have to look at some of the issues at a global scale that impact women or impact South Africa and South Africa's economy and South Africa's social services sector. So we cannot divorce the status of women in South Africa from all the global issues that are happening currently. But just looking at, the status of women, if you look at how far we've come, 30 years on, seven, you know, democratic governments later, women in South Africa still continue to be on the economic margins. Women in South Africa continue to be on the social margins. And, the political participation of women is still very fragmented. There is very little we can say about women in strategic decision-making positions. Women's education levels still continue to be much lower than, you know, the average South African. And so all of those things compounded, and including, you know, what a violent society we are, and clearly how that impacts gender-based violence and women in particular. So all of those things suggest a very grim picture of, the status of women in South Africa.
Bongani, just to pick up on one issue there that I think has, from a national perspective, been quite profiled, but it's not necessarily reducing, it's not necessarily producing reduced results when it comes to the high rates, and that's gender-based violence, right? We've even gotten to a point in this country where at some point it was named a national pandemic, and that all the forces of the state, would be used to try and fight this pandemic. And yet, the reality we're dealing with is not of declining levels of violence against women, but increasing levels of violence against women.
Yeah, look, it's thanks, Kathy. I mean, it is true. You know, interestingly, during the hard lockdowns between level 4 and level 5, you know, if you can recall, there was an increase in the number of GBV incidents during that time. And I remember President Ramaphosa coming out to say, you know, GBV has become a twin pandemic for us as a country. And I think, you know, it was so severe that, you know, it took place during the hard lockdown, which for us as an organization really, you know, just highlighted the fact that, you know, if nothing happens to really address issues around gender-based violence, you know, there's no amount of, you know, whether you want to call it is a lockdown or, you know, lack of interventions thereof, you know, because then it's going to make the incidence of GBV to actually get worse. I mean, I have concluded, Kathy, that in fact the pervasiveness of GBV in this country, it is a result of, you know, the lack of political will. I think if you can remember when we passed tobacco legislation, there was so much political will in South Africa, and, you know, government, you know, was in one goal, one vision. You know, this is what we want to do. This is what we want to do. And I think we've actually not seen that, you know, clearly demonstrated when it comes to GBV. But it's also because, you know, some of the, you know, people in leadership, whether past and present, have also been perpetrators of this violence. You know what I mean? So for us, you know, it is really about then how do we hold our leaders to account? You know, how do we make sure that the leaders who've been accused, you know, of being perpetrators of violence, they're really, you know, held to account, and then there's like severe consequences. So what we've seen is that, you know, every time there's an accusation against, you know, a leader who is in government, it's like, you know, they just slap them in the hand, and then, you know, whatever that they give them. You know, if you can remember the case of former Deputy Minister Manana at the time, you know, when he was accused, it was just like a slap in the wrist, you know, and then it was sort of like then redeployed to do other things. So similarly, even, you know, with the former President Zuma, you know, a case, I mean, we know what had happened there, but, you know, there wasn't really, and interestingly, in fact, it was supported by even, you know, some, like, I think, I can't remember, was the president of the Women's League at the time. But we've actually just seen how, when it's, you know, it's about, you know, leaders in our country who are being accused of GBV, just, you know, the kind of support that they get, but also the lack of accountability and severe consequences that, you know, they have to be, that they had to take. So for me, you know, it is really about political willingness to really deal with the issue, not necessarily to throw money at the issue. Money, yes, it is important, but what are some of the consequences that needs to be taken
And perhaps to add to that, Bongani, of course, we've also had examples where when there are allegations made against some of these leaders, it's explained away as, you know, sabotage from political foes, and somehow, you know, it seems to justify it being swept under the carpet. So Bongiwe, it seems to me then, more broadly, GBV becomes an important area of intervention if we are then to talk about programs that truly invest in justice and equality for women.
Absolutely, Kathy. So, in fact, the way we look at gender-based violence is multifaceted. First of all, we must recognize the violence in this country. In fact, if you look at the statistics, you know, I often refer to murder because I think it's easier to work with murder. If you look at all of all the murders in South Africa, only 20% are are gender-based violence related. So only 20% are femicide. So we still have that 80% that is not. So I think Bongani is right to talk about political will, and I think political will broader than just gender-based violence, but political will to deal with you know, some of the social issues that you know, beset South Africans right now. But coming back to the issue of gender-based violence and domestic violence, I think what we have seen over the years is that we have a system and we've got all these laws, and I think we have a tendency to think that the laws alone will make a difference. And in the case of domestic violence, it's very clear that the laws are not all that is are not going to be the panacea to the problem. We need to be looking deeply. We need to be looking at the socio-cultural context. We need to be looking at women's economic empowerment as a way out of gender-based violence. So for that reason, our approach as Hlanganisa to gender-based violence has been to look at what is happening within the socio-cultural context and to speak to women. And in speaking to women, what we realize is that women recognize the legislative framework that exists, but often tell us that it's actually inadequate. It's not even, you know, the go-to place. You know, GBV has been criminalized, rightfully so, but women are saying we don't want our partners criminalized necessarily. So where do you go from there once somebody has said that? And so we've been trying to think innovatively about how we deal with gender-based violence in a culturally sensitive way, but in a way that also supports women and gives them the choices, gives them a choice on how they want to pursue the violence that is happening in their lives. And through a program that we call the Sisterhood Advocates program, we've built a network of women who we've trained in GBV paralegalism, but also, you know, who are aware and very much steeped in the socio-cultural context of women in South Africa. And those women who we call Sisterhood Advocates have been handling, you know, along with the police and other government services, domestic violence cases, and helping women, hand-holding them to open cases at the police station, to go and apply for protection orders, helping them through their faith, you know, within the churches, within, you know, women's, you know, safe spaces within community, helping them navigate GBV from a cultural perspective. And we think that therein lies the answer. If we want to deal with GBV, it's not just the legislation. We've got to do the difficult work of changing social norms, changing cultural norms, looking at what are some of the social drivers of gender-based violence and addressing them comprehensively.
Bongiwe, I wanted to expand on this point for me, where you say that the legislative framework is simply not enough and that it is not adequate. What we have largely understood about why women often don't report cases is largely as a result of the failures of the criminal justice system, that while people don't have confidence in the system, when they report, they're not treated in a way that actually speaks to their needs at the time as victims. But what you're saying suggests then that the issue is actually more complex, that even if you had a fully functional criminal justice system, it would not necessarily result in all women that are victims of gender-based violence coming forward to report those crimes.
Absolutely. So it's not one or the other, Kathy. It's both. So we need to fix the justice system so that it's women-centered, so that, you know, police stations are accessible to women, so that the court system is, you know, victim centered. You know, we've got a very adversarial, you know, kind of prosecution. It's not inquisitive. It's not trying to get information. It's always trying to discredit the witness or the survivor in this case. So all of those things, you know, contribute to women's confidence in the justice system or comfort in the justice system. We hear of dockets going missing. We hear of perpetrators being released prematurely without, any explanation. And all of those things also contribute to the lack of confidence in the justice system. But we also have women who make a deliberate choice, who say to us, once you go to the police, there's a line that has been crossed in that relationship, and you must accept that the possibility of mending that relationship is also at stake. Now, what do you do for a woman like that? And so we're saying, let's not throw go to the police station at everybody. Let's allow women who still want to go through mediation, who still want to go through, other forms of, intervention, to be assisted and to be given, the dignity that they deserve in the choices that they make. Another interesting thing, Kathy, we often talk about the formal justice system. In South Africa, we do know that over 60% of cases of any disputes get resolved outside of the justice system, of the formal justice system. Many ordinary South Africans can't afford lawyers, and the criminal justice system is geared towards legal representation, which is not always affordable or even accessible. So for that reason, a lot of these cases are in any case being dealt with through traditional court systems and so on and so forth. And yet, the resourcing has always focused on the formal justice system. So we are saying we have a justice gap in South Africa. Women are not getting justice, and that's because we've defined justice very narrowly. So can we look at what options exist and resource all of those options? If community-based paralegalism is an option, let's resource it as much as we have resourced our courts and so on and so forth, so that women can access justice in a culturally sensitive way that actually advances their own goals within their relationships.
Bongani, this approach, as you take it, what have you found to be the responses of women? And, I'm also thinking about perhaps the approach that you would have to take as Hlanganisa, because when one arrives on the scene of where gender-based violence has taken place, it is a crime scene. How do you respond to a crime scene and not want to follow through with what then would be the natural steps that would be assumed after that, and actually leave the decision making in the hands of the victim?
Yeah. So one of the first things that we do when a woman comes to any of our offices where we operate, then we've got counselors who really intervene at a level of containing the woman who's come to report the case. And then they would, explain to them what rights do they have, and the different options, like to say that, they can open a case. And then, this is the process. And then those who opt, to move forward with their, to open, to press charges, they assist them with legal advice, including what then goes through into the preparing for court, etc., etc. On the other hand, as Bongi mentioned, you do have women who opt not to press charges, but then they want the violence to stop. So then, what then do you do in that case? So we through our counselors, we then we write a correspondence to the perpetrator to say that there is this intervention. The your partner doesn't want to press charges against you, but then you need to come, and then we get into this intervention of couple counseling. Depending then how it goes, I mean, like most of it that have taken place thus far, the women that with their partners that have gone through this intervention, they report that the violence has stopped for now, but then those where the violence hasn't really stopped, then they continue to pursue the cases. But also over and above that, one of the there's been quite a number of learnings with this intervention, Kathy, because we've also been able to uncover, for instance, the many cases of GBV that went unreported. through the door-to-door visits that our sisterhood advocates, conduct in the different communities that they're in.
Sure.
So
Bongani, sorry to interject there. I'm going to give you a chance to continue in a moment. It's time for the latest news headlines, and of course, we'll continue with this conversation shortly.
Cathy Motlhatlana, weekdays, 9 a.m. till midday.
All right, you're listening to The Talking Point. We're in conversation with the Hlanganisa Community Fund for Social and Gender Justice, and we're speaking about some of the interventions that they are running, particularly when it comes to gender-based violence, but of course also more broadly taking a look at their report that looks at the state of women 30 years into democracy. I'll take your calls shortly, but Bongani, I want to give you a chance just to conclude that feedback you are giving us just around, some of the challenges and that you face on the ground in communities when doing this work.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. So I was saying that one of the interventions, on a weekly basis, these women who are sisterhood advocates, they conduct household visits where they go to each house to really uncover, cases of GBV that went unreported, because women were despondent, or based on what they've heard, that the system is brutal towards men. If you report a case, the perpetrator is gonna get out, etc., etc. So then they're able then to link those women for psychosocial support, which is very important, and then they still then help those who still want to pursue the cases to open those cases. We've also had, seen cases of women whom, when they end relationships with their abusive perpetrators or partners, the partners withhold their IDs and the birth certificates for their children. So some of them, they can't even access social grants because then they don't have those official documents. So one of the interventions that we've actually also put into place is to really assist those women to get, new ID documents, including the new birth certificates for their children. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that. How has this approach been received, Bongiwe?
I think, women enjoy having a choice. So women appreciate being handheld and being told what is available and being assisted to navigate the system. So just from an effectiveness, the intervention has been very effective. What it has also achieved is that it's built a lot more accountability within government departments. So for instance, many women report that the police expose them to secondary victimization. Now, our sisterhood advocates are there to assist the women and to assist them deal with some of these attitudinal issues coming from the government services. But also the linkages between your Department of Social Development, your Department of Health, your police, and so on and so forth have been very poor. And I think, and all of those stakeholders are important in resolving, cases of violence. So from that perspective, again, the program has been very effective in improving relations at a local level between those stakeholders who are critical in advancing the cases that these women bring to the fore.
Let me take some of our callers, bring them into this conversation. In the Eastern Cape, Churchill, good morning.
Good morning, Katie. How are you?
Good, thank you, Churchill. Go for it.
I'm fine. Yeah, I'm listening to your guest there, but I think there's a lot of issues with the gender-based violence. For instance, I'm looking at our policemen and women, who are their level of education, also who are not highly trained in as far as understanding of the law, because we find that when they get to that witness box, they are torn apart by their highly trained advocates, and these cases then collapse. Absolutely. And I so wish that if there could be some special teams of men and women who are trained from the lower levels to deal with these cases, understanding specifically gender-based violence. if we are to be able to deal with this. Because honestly, when they get to court, they are torn apart by these trained advocates. And the case collapses. They become an embarrassment. They panic. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Churchill, I want you to stay on the line. And Bongiwe, what has been your experience? And maybe respond directly to Churchill.
So Churchill is absolutely right. What we see is that the problem starts with opening the case. So if your case is not watertight at the point at which you are giving a statement, that statement is what carries the case throughout, you know, for its in its life journey. Now, the importance of having these sisterhood advocates is that they are there to help you write or narrate the story in when you're opening the case. What we have seen, and I think it's something that we need to be having a conversation about, when you are a survivor of violence, you experience violence, and in that traumatized state, you are expected to go and write a statement or give a statement to the police. The perpetrator, on the other hand, is not expected to go and give a statement at that point in time. In fact, the perpetrator's statement can be done after seeking legal counsel. So by the time they get there, their story has been refined and the circumstances have been evaluated. And if they've got a strong legal counsel, their statement has the benefit of having been of having considered what your statement was, what the circumstances were, and so on and so forth. So the starting point is we want that statement to cover all the bases. We want it to be watertight. We want to, and this is where the sisterhood element comes in, because when you are asked by police about the circumstances of a traumatic, intimate event like that one, there's a much wider, gap, between the survivor and the police. But if you have somebody who is sitting by your side and saying, tell this story, do you remember what happened after that? And then what did you do? What time was it? All the important things that make up a case. We have found that that is actually useful. But going further than that, you're right. I mean, the court system has also been, we have to interrogate it, because the court system right now is designed to break down victims, in terms of the nature of, the prosecution. So your defense lawyers are there trying to discredit the victims. And we've seen how they even go into past sexual history, as if your sexual history has any bearing to you being violated at this point in time. So it's about discrediting the witness, and I think it's an important point. And we need to be engaging with how our courts are dealing with victims of violence.
All right, thanks for that contribution, yeah. Churchill. Yeah. Thanks for bringing it up. Anything else you want to add?
Yes. Yeah. No. I think that I understand what my sister is saying. I understand that the cases have to be investigated by the investigators. Then they go to the NPA, that makes sure those are prosecutors that make sure that it's a watertight case. Then it goes to court. But what I'm concerned about is when that investigator gets to the witness box. Remember, they are on their own there. Then gets cross-examined. That's when everything falls apart. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? That's why I'm saying, if we could have a situation whereby, we up the game in as far as training our policemen and women in these cases, level of education, and highly competent in as far as dealing with these and understanding of the law. Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
I hear you, Churchill.
That's my main point here.
Okay.
I understand on the side of the prosecutors would prosecute, but when they are being cross-examined by a highly trained senior counsel, you would see what happens there.
All right, Churchill, let's leave it there. Borders, I'm squeezing you in here. Good morning.
Hi, Gizzy.
Yes.
I think the Western way or the Eurocentric way of trying these cases has just failed us. Indeed, really, we have to take into consideration the traditional or the tribal way or the traditional system where some of these things are happening. A traditional opinion really has to be considered, because some of these cases are taking place in our rural areas. As we have heard, over in many cases whereby the women and the elderly are being killed, you know. Then now, when these cases, some of them, they have that these established courts have to refer some of these things to the traditional, where we try these cases and have some, our recommendations from the traditional way must be taken into consideration.
All right, Borders, thanks for that contribution.
Two things, and again, the government has to deploy the intelligence agencies into our rural areas, where these cases are mostly occurring, because the elderly are being killed, or else the old age homes have to be established in our rural areas.
Okay.
That is my take.
Thank you for that contribution. Bongani, where can people go to get in touch with you as an organization? Very briefly, please. I've got 30 seconds left.
Yeah, sure. They can go on our website and all our social media pages. Hlanganisa Community Fund, that is where they can get hold of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both you, Bongani, and Bongiwe, for being part of this conversation. It brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. Of course, The Talking Point, back with you again tomorrow morning between 9 o'clock and midday. Have yourselves a lovely afternoon. Up next is...